I think in the sense of it being standard for people to have their genome sequenced and be able to have that themselves. So if that was me, I'm like, all right, cool. I have a hard drive or a very secure link in the cloud or something where I can then go into, let's say I have an accident. I can go into an ER and be like, hey, I'm going to need some kind of pain medication for whatever happened in this car accident. Here's my genome. Please look to see what's going to be the medication that is going to be most effective for me in terms of my genetic predisposition, but also look at my sex, also look at my age, my BMI, all these factors. I think even looking at, okay, is anyone in the family, any drugs that have worked well for them? Because I share genetic information with my bio family, right? But isn't it going to be better just to look at my genetics and say, hey, we're going to look at these certain variants?
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome back to Real Pharma. I'm your host, Ian Wendt, joined by the Epicurean, Dr. Nari O. In today's episode, we're excited to welcome a trailblazer at the frontier of genomics and personalized medicine, the one and only Kira Dineen. So Kira's journey includes a rich background in genetic counseling, augmented by her role as the visionary host of the DNA Today podcast. Through her academic pursuits and her dedication to genetic education, Kira has really carved out a niche as a leading voice in discussing the complex ethical, social, and practical implications of genetic advances. Kira's work is essential for anyone looking to understand the rapidly evolving landscape of genetics and its intersection with healthcare. Her ability to break down complex scientific concepts into relatable insights has made her a beloved figure among professionals and enthusiasts alike. As we explore the latest in genetic research and its implications for the biopharmaceutical industry, Kira's expertise promises to enlighten us on how these advancements are shaping the future of medicine, ethics, and society at large. So join us as we delve into a conversation with Kira Dineen, where science meets the human story. Let's discover together how the threads of our DNA weave into the broader fabric of our lives and the healthcare landscape. Welcome, Kira, to what promises to be a captivating and enlightening episode.
Thanks for having me on, Ian, and good to see you, Nari. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Welcome, welcome.
We are doing great. Yeah, thanks so much for your time, and we're really looking forward to this discussion. Kira, for our listeners who might be more familiar with the biopharma side of things, could you give us a quick rundown of how genomics may be revolutionizing our approach to healthcare?
Yeah, just quick rundown, just totally how it works in like 30 seconds, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could sum that up exactly. In a paragraph, right?
Real easy, yeah. It's not like it's complex at all. So, I mean, I think it's really cool if we look at how fast, and you guys know so much more about the pharmacy side of things and stuff, right? And biopharm is like where our careers intersect, which is, I think, what's going to make this a really cool conversation for us to learn from each other. But I think when it comes to genomics and genetic information, I mean, we finished the Human Genome Project in 2003. And I say finished kind of in air quotes because it's an audio podcast. But in those 20 years since then, I mean, we've now been able to understand a lot of what we were able to basically sequence. So what we were able to read, that's step one. And then step two is like, well, what does all of this mean? And so I think when it comes to the biopharma side of things, it's looking at how can we understand this genetic information and how it can apply to personalized or precision medicine, because that's where we intersect in terms of my genomics and genetics career, you guys in the pharmacy area and the pharmaceutical industry of like, how can we use this genetic information to then tailor medications and dosages of medications to be like, you have this genetic predisposition. Let's set you up with this certain drug and dosage, because this is going to be a better guess as opposed to just, all right, this is what we usually start patients on. So it's kind of being a little bit more of like a guesstimate rather than total guess. So I think that's kind of where I look at with the biopharma side of things, just in terms of the field in general. And we've been doing this, but it's going to really take off. I think we're just at the infancy of using this genetic information to tailor how we are prescribing medication, because everybody's on a med, right? I mean, if you don't take a daily med, you've been on medication over your life and you will be on different medications in the future. So that's something that impacts everybody.
Right. That's a really great take on it. Sometimes people forget this is not just in the context of a specific drug or maybe a specific trial. This goes way beyond that. And before we dive into that, I would love to also hear a little bit more about your personal journey. So you have this really interesting background. You're a genetics counselor, but you've also done digital media for over a decade. I mean, really so early on with your various podcasts and radio and everything that you're doing. What prompted you to carve out this niche, as Ian said in his introduction? What fuels that?
Yeah, I think for me, I started podcasting in high school. And I just saw it as such an opportunity that you can kind of get into podcasting without having a ton of equipment, without having a lot of money, without having a lot of expertise. And you can certainly then start elevating your brand and all that and put money into it, but you don't have to. So I think in other areas, the point of entry, you kind of have to have a lot to get into. So I saw podcasting as a cool way to explore careers, specifically in the genetic space. So science was my favorite subject in school growing up. And then we got to the genetics unit and I was like, whoa, this is really cool. And just how many questions I would ask in class in seventh grade and then once you get to high school and all that. And the teachers are like, well, we haven't figured that out as scientists yet. And I'm like, wow, so like maybe we will in my lifetime. And I think just as you guys have seen in the pharmacy industry, like so much changes and develops. So I think that was what was interesting to me. And when it came to the podcasting space, I was like, well, people aren't going to meet with a high schooler necessarily. They're going to save their time, understandably, for like college students and people a little bit further along in their education and careers. But I was like, well, if I say I want to interview them for a show, maybe they'll take a meeting with me. So it was totally selfish reasons at the beginning of just, I want to meet people and learn about careers, specifically in genetics. And I had heard of genetic counseling before starting the show. But then I got to meet with a bunch of genetic counselors and talk to them about like, well, how does this work in these different areas that you work in? And I was like, wow, like, yeah, I totally want to do this. So I think it was a really great way of meeting with people. And I'm sure like you guys have had really cool guests on the show too. So I think that hopefully resonates with you guys. So I think just kind of, yeah, learning from people. And podcasting is so cool because you get on a call like we are now and you just dive right into a really cool conversation, right? You talk for like 2 minutes, how's your day? And then you just go right into, let's talk about what's interesting in your life, what you've learned. I love that concept of really being able to maximize the time you have with people.
Love it. Thank you. And I mean, for anybody who is not familiar with your main podcast, which is the DNA Today podcast, I highly recommend that you check it out there. Over 250 episodes. You've been doing this for a decade. And you got recognized also with the Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award 3 years in a row, 2020 to 2022. That says something. And it's just a huge treasure trove of topics that you're covering there with really a variety of guests. And I think to your point, one can tell that you're really passionate about this because the topics are really super interesting and you have so much energy on the shows, but it's really informative. And these are topics that affect people. Some of them are very, very niche. Very few people are affected, like some ultra rare diseases that you cover. But other topics are much more general. And I think that brings us back to what we discussed before this question. How is this going to affect all of us?
So let me build on that. Yeah, and really impressive story, Kira. Love to hear that and really inspiring. Of course, we're seeing, and you mentioned this, right? We're seeing this trend towards personalized medicine within biopharma. And that can mean a lot of different things. In my opinion, we're very crudely applying personalized approach to medicine or therapeutics historically. And here's what I mean by that. So for example, you might dose medications or decide one medication is a better fit for a patient on a variety of different factors. Could be age, could be gender, could be disease progression, could be a variety of other things that tend to bucket people in still very large buckets, not very personalized from that perspective, right? And maybe one step beyond that, you know, you have some medications that are dosed on body surface area or by weight or some quantitative metric like that. But again, still not particularly personalized. And now, you know, at the other end of the extreme, we're seeing kind of this one-to-one relationship between, in some cases, the drug and the patient. There's one drug that's engineered for that single individual patient, which is pretty amazing when you think about it, right? The drug wouldn't work or isn't appropriate for
anybody else on the planet. It's been specifically designed for you if you're that patient. So we see this trend heading in that direction. What's really propelling this movement? And maybe what are the implications for drug development if you have some comments there? Because is it just the technology allowing us to develop drugs that way that just didn't exist? And you know, you talked about genetic sequencing is maybe the impetus to a lot of this. But what else has occurred? And CRISPR is probably something that comes to mind for people, I guess, as well. But what is the technology that got us to this point? And what's going on today that gets us to the next goal that we have in mind?
I think a big part of that is, as I said earlier, just being able to finish the human genome sequence so that we have that information. And that was huge, right? Big landmark. The next part is like, okay, you know, we had that, but now we need to just sequence as many genomes as we can so we can build up that database to understand, I'm going to have genetic changes that you guys don't have. So I have blue eyes. For those that don't know, you guys look like you have brown eyes, maybe. So we have different genetic variants there. One is not better than the other. It's just different. So that's a lot of what we need to be looking at. But also there are genetic variants where that can lead to disease. And so looking at that, we have to figure out, all right, of these genetic changes that we're looking at, which are the ones that are like, does it matter? It's just part of human diversity. Which are the ones that actually lead to human disease? And understanding the difference between them. Genetics is so complicated. It's like, you know, as you guys mentioned, I've been doing my show DNA Today for almost 12 years. And it's like, as I do it, I just realize how little we do know, right? And so I think with that, it's like we have to get more and more genomes, so the entirety of someone's genetic information in these databases, because the way we started was with people of recent European ancestry. And so that is really what the databases have started with. So when we start looking at people that do not have European ancestry, they're going to have a lot more, and I have European ancestry. So people that don't have that, they're going to have a lot more of these, what we call variants of uncertain significance, where we say, we see that there is a genetic change here, but we don't know. Is that benign? Just doesn't matter. Everybody's different. Or is that something that leads to disease or symptoms or something in that realm? And figuring out the difference between them, we need a lot more data to be able to do that and have that where we say we have enough of these variants, these genetic changes in our database to say we can feel statistically confident in saying that this is pathogenic or benign. So that's something that we really need to be working on it. And we are.
What's the barrier to building out that data set though?
I think part of it is reaching out to people and having them feel comfortable being a participant in research. If you look at the history of having people be in research and providing samples and information, as scientists, as doctors and in healthcare, we've done a very poor job in history, especially I think with the African American community. I think we can look at cases like Henrietta Lacks, where it's atrocious what their family was not informed about, even in the 70s, when they went back to the family and said, hey, we need some blood samples because we're trying to figure out more information. And for those that aren't familiar, Henrietta Lacks was a Black woman who was diagnosed with cancer. Cells were taken from her, and those cells allowed us to figure out how to culture cells. You think about all the downstream effects of how we were then able to learn so much from culturing cells. If anyone has ever worked in a lab, in a wet lab, you've done it. Vaccine development, there are so many things that came out of that, but it is just heartbreaking and just highly disturbing that even in the 70s, the family was confused and their education level was not as high as the scientists and people kind of coming to them. And they didn't understand, is Henrietta Lacks alive? Because they're talking about her cells growing and how does this work? And understandable, right? So I think when we look at cases like that, and that's just one, I mean, the Tuskegee trials, there's just so much that is just tumultuous and just absolutely horrendous, where we need to do a better job as scientists to be educating and be saying to people, you are a partner in this research, you are a participant, we are doing this together. And so I think when we look at that, it's understandable that people are hesitant to be involved in research and contributing on their end because of this. So it's like, I think, you know, shows like yours, we really need this, right? And this education, this transparency with it. Because once we have a better relationship and trust with a lot of people from different walks of life and ethnic backgrounds, then we can start building up these databases faster and better. So then we can give better medical information to people for those downstream effects.
Yeah, totally agree with you. And we actually covered a lot of what you just touched on with Arthur Kaplan, who's a bioethicist, and another episode as well.
Oh my gosh, you had Arthur Kaplan on?
Yeah.
Wow, big name.
Yeah.
Check out episode number 2, and we did explore those issues. And yeah, I mean, so important. And we really did explore kind of informed consent and what that really means. And he had some really interesting ways for us to kind of challenge our thinking on that.
Kara, I think you just kind of opened the door to a big topic that I wanted to explore with you, which is ethics and ethical considerations. I mean, we can't talk about genetics without talking about ethics. And there are a lot of different aspects to it. So what I wanted to get your thoughts on are things like, you already mentioned access and equitable access to information that you can use then to make informed decisions. So we have an imbalance there with regards to maybe different ethnic groups, different demographic groups, socioeconomic considerations probably play a role here as well. But of course, as much as we celebrate having this information now and knowing more about the human genome, it's really unclear how this is being used and, you know, in which framework. And we've seen things like the use of CRISPR in a way that was not really in line with what we would consider global scientific consensus. We just saw issues with protection of privacy with 23andMe. We have to think about things like, are people going to be denied access to healthcare insurance or employment or other really important aspects of life because of their genetic information and how it's being used or misused? So there's a lot there, but I wanted to get your thoughts on some of these really important considerations. So I feel like, in a certain sense, our thinking about the ethical considerations has not kept pace with the scientific advances.
And it makes sense because for us being able to develop this technology and what we're learning, it's just happening so rapidly. I think, and I'm biased, but I think genetics is one of the areas of healthcare and science that's growing the fastest. And just how many new publications is out there, it's just like you could spend all day just trying to keep up with that. And I try, but I think when it comes to that, it makes sense that just because we can do something, should we? That's a big kind of concept in that phrasing, not just in genetics, but I think in bioethics in general. And I'm sure Dr. Kaplan kind of talked about that on his episode number 2, I'm learning, which I'm gonna have to listen to right after this. But I think when it comes to a lot of that, it's tough because we want to be advancing science. We don't want to be limiting ourselves in terms of what we're able to develop and learn. But then it gets to a point, okay, we've done something. How does that affect people? And I think when it comes to the biopharma side of things, what I think about too is we've developed a lot of really exciting drugs where we've been able to learn about the genetics, use that to develop a drug that specifically helps people with a certain genetic change. But it's so expensive. Just because we've done it doesn't mean people are even going to have access to it. So yeah, maybe people that are in the top 1% financially are going to be able to afford that. But not even who can afford it, but also who is diagnosed with a condition fast enough to be able to get access to this drug, even if they have all the money in the world. So I think there's all these factors where in the scientific community, we celebrate these milestones of, wow, we developed this. The drug was FDA approved. And that is so important. And we still need to do that. But that's just the first milestone. Then we need to be like, how are we going to have people actually be able to afford this drug? Where can they go to even access this drug? So do they need to go to a certain medical center where that's not in their country? That's not in an area where they can even drive to. So I think there's so many factors there where it's like so exciting when we have a new FDA approved drug that is specifically for a genetic condition with a certain genetic change. But then it's like, all right, well, how are we able to have people actually get to this drug? And all the factors that go into it that I mentioned.
Absolutely. That's exactly where I was going with this as well. It's not just we have the scientific advances. It's how do we get it to the people who need it? And how do we do that in a fair manner, in an equitable manner? And I think that's definitely where a lot of questions are still unanswered. But beyond that, also, another point is so we have the ability to, at least in certain groups now, pinpoint when something is not the way that it should be, when something is wrong, so to speak. But I've also heard that some people who have what we would consider a disability, they actually don't want that to change. They wouldn't change it if they could. So who are we to say you are not perfect, right? Who decides that? Who gets to decide this is a disease, this is an illness, this is an aberration?
I think a great example of that is the deaf community. So I am not in the deaf community. However, I've learned a lot through people that have hearing loss and whatever term that they identify with in this space, that a lot of people do not see this as a medical issue. And it's more, okay, this is what makes me different. And there is a vibrant community for people who are deaf. And there is just so much culture there in terms of sign language and all the different types of sign language, depending on where they are in the world. And being able to connect with each other. And there's, you know, colleges, Gaudet is one I think of, if I'm pronouncing that right, specifically for people who are deaf. And there's just this really amazing community that, you know, I really admire just what they've been able to build up. And what happens when, even in my own practice, I see patients in the pregnancy space where there's a certain condition, non-syndromic hearing loss, GJB2, I believe is the gene, where that's autosomal recessive. For people going back to high school, oh, how did that work? The Punnett squares, right? You draw the squares. If both parents are biological carriers for this condition where they're not affected themselves and they have a child together, there's a 25% chance of passing this along. That's always one, I think, that comes up as an example of how is this going to change? Let's say this is a condition that is on carrier screening. So something that a lot of people are offered when they're pregnant or before trying to conceive. Are people going to start learning more about this type of deafness and saying, well, we want to do testing during pregnancy to see if this pregnancy actually inherit this genetic change that will lead to deafness? And people may be in the position where they say, we may terminate for this, or we may continue pregnancy. Or the other way around, where a couple is both deaf and they say, we want to have a deaf child because this is our culture. And who am I to say as a hearing person that that's wrong, right? So, I mean, there's just, it's so layered. And I think that especially we mentioned, I think, Ian, you mentioned CRISPR and being able to not only select an embryo that in this example of mine that is deaf or will not be deaf, but being able to edit the genetics to say, this would have been someone that's deaf, but we're going to edit it so that this person will be hearing. So, I mean, there's just so much to, I think, unpack in this space, but I think when it comes to things that we talk about, well, is this a medical condition or is it just something that some people would say is a disability and identify in that way? And some people say, no, this is just kind of who I am and in a aspect about me. So I think that's where it gets complicated from an ethics perspective.
Well, and even potentially complicate this a little more, because I think there's a spectrum of applications of this technology, right? So that at one end, maybe it's where we can all agree that the burden of illness is significant in the sense that it's shortening lifespan or harming a person in a way that maybe we can all agree that there's something we want to fix. There's kind of this maybe middle or gray area where there might be different perspectives that you and Nari have been talking about. But then to extend that out, there might be areas that nobody really views as a medical issue, but can be complicated from an ethical perspective. You know, what happens if you want your child to be taller or change the color of their hair or their eyes or whatever other characteristic? There's all kinds of really difficult considerations that could come out of that. And you said something earlier, are the ethics keeping up with the technology? And I think always the burden, I think, on us is that technology leads, and then we try to figure out how to manage the ethical considerations that we are the second order effects of that technology that we didn't predict, right? So and maybe that's where we are right now. But I wonder, what is the framework to manage that? I mean, of course, in a drug development setting, we have IRBs or institutional review boards that help in that area, but they're not always looking, they're looking at the individual patient, maybe during the period of time that they're under study, not looking at the second order effects or the societal effects that maybe are larger ones. And I wonder, is there any structure to that? Or is there organizations that are really trying to figure this stuff out?
Yeah, I think I'd have to do a little bit more research to be able to name some organizations. But I think one thing to think about is, you know, I'm US-based, so that's kind of where I'm coming from. But even if we have laws in the US to prevent certain type of, you know, genetic editing happening, especially on the embryo level, where then we're introducing a genetic change into the human population because that will be passed down through generations if that person has biological children. We can have those laws to prevent that and make that illegal, but not every country is going to do that. So there's this concept of medical tourism where, oh, you can go somewhere for a cheaper procedure or go somewhere where this concept, this testing, this procedure is not illegal, whereas in your home country, it is. So I think that's where we get into the really tough parts, because we saw, and we've kind of, I feel like, alluded to it, I believe it was the end of 2018, is when we had a scientist in China say, hey, guess what I did? I edited embryos, implanted that into a person, and that was a successful pregnancy. And now there's three kids out in the world, two of them are twins to each other, that allegedly had their embryos edited. And now if they have kids, we're introducing that into the human population. This was shocking to me. I don't know if you guys remember seeing these headlines at the end of 2018. And just, I did not think I would see that in 2018. I'm still floored and it's 2024. And to be fair, that scientist went against guidelines of the organization, university he was with. So he did do things that were against the rules and probably illegal too. But it's going to happen more and more. So I'm actually happy but surprised that we haven't seen more scientists come out and be like, hey, I did this.
Well, he did go to jail for a period of time.
He did. I think he's out now.
He's out now. And his goal was to confer some immunity from HIV acquisition in these particular patients. And I don't think we know entirely if that was successful. Very hard thing to ethically test, but certainly the wrong way to go about it.
And so interesting of what he chose to target. So these were pregnancies that, to my knowledge, did not have a high risk of being infected from HIV. So I don't really understand why he chose this, and not something that, as you kind of mentioned, Ian, of a condition that, you know, probably the three of us and people listening would be like, yes, this is a condition that is so detrimental and we can edit this. And that would be the only way for people to have a biological child that is healthy. So I think something like Huntington's disease, Tay-Sachs, I think these are conditions where they are very, very devastating conditions. And to me, that would make a little bit more sense. I don't know if I'd sign off on it, right? I don't think we're at the point where we should be doing that. But in terms of an indication, when it's a severe, lethal condition, that makes a little more sense to me.
Oh, you're right. It didn't really make a lot of sense in terms of how he presented it. And there was probably something else behind it. But to your point, we're basically working against the least common denominator. I mean, it takes a rogue scientist in a country where there are no regulations, or in this case, he went against regulations and the damage is done. So what are you going to do then?
And it's so easy.
It is so easy.
Like CRISPR is so easy to use, and I sadly have not been able to play with it yet. If anyone wants to invite me in their lab and show me how they do it, I would absolutely love that. But compared to other genetic editing technology we had before that, zinc fingers, Talon, that was a little bit harder to work with. You really had to know what you were doing. But with CRISPR, it's so easy that people can set up their own lab at home and play with it. So maybe that's what I should do.
And again, we come back to the question of access and equity. So if that is what's the trend, are we going to see the same thing now that we see with survival bunkers where all the billionaires have one? So all the billionaires will have their own CRISPR lab at home?
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, it's going to be the next Marvel movie, probably.
Yeah.
And then it will be real life.
Yeah, and we're not at the point yet where we can really fully understand the long-term consequences, obviously, especially if it spans multiple generations.
Yeah, and you mentioned a good thing with that, because I said off-target effects, but I didn't really explain what that it was for people that aren't total genetic person. When we use CRISPR, we're targeting a certain spot in the genome to be like, hey, cut this piece out and then introduce a new piece of DNA to basically replace it. So if you're in a Word doc and you highlight a sentence and then you hit paste, you're just replacing that sentence with a new one. So if there was a bunch of grammar changes or there's one spelling mistake, but I'm like, all right, I'm going to replace this word. That's kind of how it works. But when you say to the CRISPR-Cas9 enzyme, hey, go to this point in the genome, what if that location you're giving it exists multiple times and now you're editing multiple points in the genome? So off target, it's not the target that you intended. And then how does that work? What if you edit something else that then leads to another disease where you quote unquote cured or fixed the first disease, but now you cause three more? So I think that's something that we have to be really, really mindful of like, we're still in the early days of CRISPR. The year my show launched in 2012 was when this big CRISPR paper came out. I believe it was Jennifer Doudna and others that were on there. And that's kind of to me like, oh, a very milestone in terms of us really understanding and learning about CRISPR and being able to now use the technology in terms of using as genetic editing for us as humans to be playing with and being more manipulative.
We talked about healthcare equity and kind of efficient healthcare resource utilization, which can be challenging whenever you have new technologies. They tend to be expensive. And of course, access is difficult at first and eventually, hopefully, becomes better and becomes available to more folks. And it struck me, I was online here the other day and I saw really a heart-wrenching plea from a family who had a child. I believe he was about 4 years old, little boy, who was suffering from Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And of course, there is a treatment that's recently become available that they felt that their child would be a candidate for. But the cost was something in the order of $3 million. And their insurer, I won't say who that is, but would not cover it. And they were kind of advocating for some social pressure on this insurance company to pay for this. We can only hope that this little boy has access to this technology. But in the foreseeable future, is this technology kind of like you think about it in the electronics world, where something that was expensive, 20 years ago, now we have a supercomputer in our pocket, right? Is it heading in that direction where it does scale or the technology becomes more accessible and cheaper so that at least, if not today, we can imagine a future, hopefully very soon, where the cost comes down?
Yeah, Ian, I think that is a great point and observation. And I think something that is kind of similar to that is the cost of sequencing. So genomic sequencing, when we're reading through and being able to say, okay, these are the letters of the genes. And the cost has just plummeted over the years. And that's why we're able to have people now do like whole genome sequencing. And that's not insane anymore to order. That is more in like a few thousand as opposed to, I don't even know how much it was. I mean, back in 2003, like it cost millions, maybe even more to be able to sequence that first genome and finish it. So I think when it comes to medications, that will be similar too. As we have more and more that are FDA approved and in the market, and I think putting pressure on insurance companies say, hey, this is for some of them kind of a cure or the closest thing I think we're going to be able to get to a cure in our lifetime. And being able to say, you need to cover this or whatever percent or something, right? So I think that it's both of that. You mentioned Duchenne muscular dystrophy. I think that is a great example of a recent FDA approved drug that is very exciting. And we're seeing really, really great results from that. But I think you're mentioning this family where the boy is about 4 years old. It's like, now is the time to get him on this drug.
Yeah, there's a time factor.
Yeah, once he's a couple more, years older, he's going to start having muscle degeneration.
Well, I think this product is only indicated for 4 to 5 year olds. So it's a very narrow window where they can actually do this intervention.
Very narrow. Yeah. And so for him, we need to do this as soon as possible. And there's even, as you're saying, like once you hit a certain age, it's not as effective because you want to be in that prevention time period and not let's prevent additional muscle degenerations. So for those that don't know, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, also known as DMD, mostly affects boys because it's an X-linked condition. And it is a devastating condition where a lot of boys are having to rely on wheelchairs to be mobile. And a lot of boys will pass away. And I mean, you know, once they're in their 20s, so not really boys anymore, but a lot of males will pass away from heart failure because of the heart muscles. And it is just such a devastating disorder. And actually, Sarepta Therapeutics is one of our sponsors on DNA Today. So I want to be clear and transparent with that. And we've been doing a series about DMD and this drug and this gene therapy and just how they've been able to develop that and what we're seeing with it. But yeah, it's important to highlight, like, all right, this is great, but it's like, how can people have access to this drug and the timing of it? A lot of people are not diagnosed until they're a little bit older and starting to have those symptoms. And then it's like, oh, if we only knew earlier. So I think there's so much with that. And I think, you know, to go get on a soapbox for a moment, as I mentioned, I'm a genetic counselor and I see people mostly that are pregnant, sometimes before they're pregnant, and that's ideal. And carrier screening is so key here. So people can find out that they're a carrier for conditions like Duchenne muscular dystrophy and have that information so that they can even test their pregnancy and do whatever they will with that information. If they decide to continue the pregnancy, they know about this so much earlier than if they had a child that starts having symptoms and then down the diagnostic odyssey. But I think when it comes back to the biopharma side, it's just so important to be diagnosing earlier. But how can we have these drugs be affordable to people? And that, I wish I had a great answer, but like, that's part of the problem. There isn't a great answer or an easy answer.
What do you see as the role of genetic testing in the development of drugs? So for instance, in clinical trials, to increase the success rate in screening the right people, or maybe further down the process as well?
I think a big part, as you said, screening. So for us to be aware, okay, we have a genetic diagnosis before we have a clinical diagnosis. So clinical diagnosis would be like, all right, this is the symptoms happening. We're going to figure out what condition you have. But genetic diagnosis, that often can happen before clinic if you have the right setup. I think when it comes to that, looking, as we mentioned at the top of the show, of saying, all right, you have a certain genetic change. Can we develop a drug specifically for that? And I think a good example of this is cystic fibrosis. So this is a condition that we've known about for many, many decades. Over the years, it has changed from a condition where some infants would pass away from this condition into now people are living in their 50s, 60s. I think people that are my age, I'm in my late 20s, may live a normal lifespan, still have medical considerations and symptoms and everything, but in terms of their lifespan and quality of life, so much better than it was, say, 50 years ago. And a big part of that is it's really interesting with the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation and others kind of with this, that they've been able to raise a lot of money. And there's this awesome book, hopefully you guys can link to in the show notes, Breath from Salt. I had the author on my show. She's just amazing. And it took her so long to write this book. It is a thick book and it is so interesting. It was a COVID read for me. For these foundations to be able to raise a bunch of money, say, all right, we're going to pour this into research drug development. We're going to develop a drug that is going to target the most common genetic cause of cystic fibrosis. So this variant called Delta 508 that a lot of people with cystic fibrosis have at least one of that. So cystic fibrosis is autosomal recessive condition. So it's like I mentioned earlier, both your parents have to be carriers for this and you inherit a genetic change from both your parents. There's two copies of the cystic fibrosis gene. So if you inherit both broken copies from each biological parent, you don't have a working copy. So then you have cystic fibrosis. There's a lot of nuances to it. It's not necessarily as straightforward as I'm saying, but that's the gist of it. And a lot of people have this Delta 508 genetic change. So they're like, all right, let's develop a drug that targets this. And they did. And then they were able to say, well, now let's sell, and you guys will please correct me because I don't know the pharmacy terms as much as you guys do, but sell the rights to it kind of thing. And say, all right, now we can take the money we earned from that, pour it into the next genetic variant. And it's really cool that a lot, and this, they were kind of very early on and novel in this sense of having a foundation being like, we're going to raise money, pour it into this, sell this drug basically, and just keep it going in this cycle. And I think they've been a great poster child for other genetic conditions and communities to do the same thing. And we now have multiple drugs for cystic fibrosis, depending on the variants that person has. So I think that's just something that is so helpful. And you think about, all right, cystic fibrosis, don't think I would necessarily say rare disorder. I don't know. It affects quite a lot of people. But what about lung issues, respiratory problems? That affects even more people. So what can we learn from cystic fibrosis and the drugs we develop for this? Could we have the FDA say, oh, we're now going to approve it for other uses too? So it's not just these drugs are helpful for the cystic fibrosis community, but can they be, and maybe they already are, helpful for other people with respiratory problems, which has really been in our world since COVID, right? Of just the symptoms from COVID.
Yeah, it's an interesting example you brought up. We recently talked about that with Jim Trinkle over at Novo Holdings VC firm, because the CF Foundation example is wonderful. I mean, a great outcome. But in some ways, you have a nonprofit becoming a little bit like a VC, right? They're investing in developing a drug and certainly commercially benefiting from it. They outlicense the product to their benefit. It's a new dynamic. I'm sure a lot of the other foundations are looking at that as a model to move forward. And I think it's just an exciting new approach to some of this work. And kind of thinking about technology and drug development world, does AI play a role here? I mean, I'm hearing that more and more, that maybe that's an accelerator to all of this. I wonder if you could just touch on that briefly.
Yeah. I mean, how can it not be at this point? I mean, just even us as podcasters, I know we both use AI to prep for interviews, to write journal, like all these different things, right? So I mean, in my own podcasting world, I certainly really take advantage of AI. I'm like, an AI to me is like, oh, one of my interns, right? Like, put AI to work. I think in the genetic space, where I see AI being really helpful in the next, I was going to say a couple of years, but maybe months, I don't know, weeks, days, of using it to go through all of this big data. In terms of our genomes, we have so many letters in the sense of genetic bases. So when we're reading through the genome, saying, okay, A, T, C, G, T, A, and going through all that. But when I mentioned earlier of looking, and we want to sequence as many genomes as we can to be in public databases so that we can then reference that and then be able to diagnose people of, is that a benign change? Is that a pathogenic change? In order for us to really be using this big data in an efficient way, I think we need to start capitalizing on AI. And I'm sure there are companies that are already starting to do this, to be able to go through and be like, hey, here's billions, billions of data points. Hey, AI, I want you to do XYZ to figure out what genetic change is common in all these people that maybe have the same clinical diagnosis, and in all these different ways. And I think too of looking with the biopharma end, all right, can we look at people that have the same diagnosis, but group them into people where this medication worked really well for them and people that the medication didn't work so well for them? Can we find common genetic changes within the people that it worked really well for? And then in the future, test people to say, hey, normally we get you on this medication for this medical indication, but we want to do genetic testing to see, do you actually have the variants where we found people are more likely to do better on this medication, or people may have an adverse reaction, right? Of a big problem in healthcare is people being diagnosed with medication and they have a reaction from the medication, and looking at dosage. So you're someone where you don't need as high of dose as someone else, or the opposite, you need a much higher dose for this to be effective. And using all that genetic information to figure it out and using AI as a tool to be able to get there faster.
Because honestly, we already have some of that information, right? We know that, for instance, men and women react differently to certain drugs, different ethnic groups react differently, BMI, age, all those factors play a role, but we are not able to customize for those factors. But maybe with the really rapid advances in AI and in this area, in this field of study, we'll get to that point. Which leads me to my next question, which is, there's so much going on. And again, as you mentioned, the pace is rapid. But are there certain areas that you're especially excited about, or something that you think is going to really be another kind of paradigm shift or huge milestone in this field?
I think in the sense of it being standard for people to have their genome sequenced and be able to have that themselves. So if that was me, I'm like, all right, cool. I have a hard drive or a very secure link in the cloud or something where I can then go into, let's say I have an accident. I can go into an ER and be like, hey, I'm going to need some kind of pain medication for whatever happened in this car accident. here's my genome. Please look to see what's going to be the medication that is going to be most effective for me in terms of my genetic predisposition, but also look at my sex, also look at my age, my BMI, all these factors. I really hope that it's not going to be, oh, the genetics is going to replace everything that you just mentioned, right? It's going to be, we're using it as another tool. I think even looking at, you can ask, okay, is anyone in the family, any drugs that have worked well for them? Because I share genetic information with my bio family, right? But isn't it going to be better just to look at my genetics and say, hey, we're going to look at these certain variants? But also on the other side, the opiate epidemic is just absolutely terrible and dreadful and such a problem. It is its own pandemic. And being able to look, I have addiction in my family, being able to look and say, okay, let's look at, here is genetic changes. Maybe we shouldn't be prescribing her an opiate. Maybe there's an alternative that we should be doing, even if it's not as effective, because we want to prevent her from being addicted to this because we see she has genetic variants prone to addiction. We've started being able to do this, but the correlations are not as strong as I want to see. But not just looking at one variant, but looking at a ton and a constellation of them, say, we're going to put all this information together and then come up with the drug and the dosage for me in the ER that I'm in pain and have to figure this out. But being able to do it quickly because I've already sequenced my genome and now I can say, reference this. And maybe using AI in the ER, this is total dreamland, right? But hopefully in the near future, being able, all right, AI, pinpoint the genetic changes that are related to pain management in terms of pharmaceuticals.
I can imagine a future where, you know, we all have like our genetic ID card that gets scanned, you know, for the situations that you describe, which sounds really interesting and exciting. It also sounds a little bit scary. Reminds me a little bit of the movie Gattaca, if you want to go back.
Oh, yeah.
And, great movie, but a cautionary tale, I think, as well. So Kira, yeah, I mean, just so much fun to explore all this with you. And I feel like I've learned a lot. And we definitely want to have you back in the future. I think there's a few different avenues we could go down a little bit more deeply for the audience that I would love to explore, certainly. But one question that we like to leave everybody with is, you know, when you think about what brought you to where you are in your career, is there anything in particular that was particularly motivational? Could have been a mentor or could have been, you know, a principal or something that really has helped shape you professionally that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, when I think about just my career for since I started the show and stuff, I think a lot about just shooting your shot. And I think I've learned that from a lot of mentors of just being able to put yourself out there and network, and you never know where it's going to go. So I think for me, a lot of my success so far, I think can be attributed to networking, and not even a sense of, oh, this person knows this person, can you introduce me, in that kind of like traditional sense, but just like going on LinkedIn and saying, okay, like I want to interview someone from this company, looking through, well, who works there and who would be good, or listening to other shows and being like, hey, like I really loved this guest. Like, let me reach out to them and just compliment them on how much I learned from their interview and how I want to have them on my show to continue that conversation that they were having. And so I think for me, a lot of it is just networking and trying. And there are so many people that I reach out to come on the show, I either never hear from, I get a no. And I'm like, yeah, all right. I never would have been able to even get a response if I didn't try, right? And we've had a lot of really exciting people on the show. We had Maury Povich on from NBC. So for those that they're like, that name is familiar, he's the guy on daytime television when you're sick home from school or work, and he's doing the paternity testing. You're the father, you're not the father. So that was so cool. And even someone like that, like you think at first, all right, it's a genetics podcast. You're having a daytime host on, where's the connection? It's like, all right, paternity testing, you know, there is a connection there. That started by me being at a concert in, you know, I used to live in Connecticut outside of New York City, and going up to the NBC booth and being like, hey, like, you know, I know you guys have a presence here in Stamford, Connecticut, and it turning into them telling me about their new podcast studio they were launching at the time in terms of getting people in, leading to conversation, you should interview Maury Povich, and you just never know. And I think always kind of having that concept about you of like, you never know, you're in a social situation that suddenly turns into a really cool business opportunity. And I think networking is just so much of where I found that success, and also just so fun to be able to connect with people and see what you have in common. And hey, I know this person, I'm going to introduce you to them. And I think that's just kind of what's really really exciting about our field, that especially in today's day and age with technologists, just being able to connect with anyone in the world.
Shoot your shot, Kira says.
Shoot your shot. You heard it here first.
Shoot your shot. Thank you, Kira. This was a great conversation. So glad that you could make it. And as Ian said, we'd definitely have to get you back. Maybe with Art Kaplan. That would be a fun episode.
Oh my gosh. I might fangirl a little too much. Yeah. I might need to be, you know, very centered before that. But no, this was really fun. You guys are so insightful and just very natural hosts and everything. So thank you so much for having me on. This was a blast.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time. We'll have you back. Bye now.
Ian, that was a really fun episode with Kira.
Yeah, I think it was. And there's so much to think about from a, you know, we tried to focus on drug development kind of related issues, but just as a general consumer, this information is going to become so important in so many different areas of our lives. And I think the democratization of this information, while very powerful, does bring up all these privacy and ethical concerns that we're in the middle of figuring out. And I think it's going to be challenging. But the good news is we have access to a really important tool, but the question remains, how do we use that ethically and responsibly?
I totally agree. I'm excited about the scientific possibilities, but on the other hand, I really do find it scary that it seems so much faster in terms of scientific progress versus how we can keep up with what does that mean ethically, morally. And it just takes one bad apple, and all of the thinking about how to do this in the right way falls by the wayside. And I think that's really one of the biggest risks. And we talked about it with Kira as well, right? Even if we have great frameworks and regulations in one part or multiple parts of the world, if there's one country where that is not the case, and with how easy it has become to engage in this area, we'll just have to see how that plays out.
Yeah, but I think these challenges or issues we're talking about right now occur anytime there's a major technological advance, whether it was the printing press or whether it's the internet. There's all this good that comes with it, but then there's things that come with it that maybe we don't like and we have to manage. We're in a similar situation. I think we can do it, but we just have to make sure we do it thoughtfully and responsibly. I'm glad there's people like Kira working on this. And of course, we talked to Dr. Arthur Kaplan, a great bioethicist that certainly can provide perspective on this in an earlier episode. So hopefully we have the right people to help us kind of navigate a pathway forward.
And we should get those two together on a future episode. I think that would be really fun as well. I agree with you. Every time that there's a major advance, there's always a concern about what does that mean and is that the right thing to do? You can't hold back progress. But in this case, because it is so invasive and is potentially so personal with regards to this is our genetic information. This is not something that's external to us. I think there's just an additional dimension of we've got to be really careful what we do here.
Yeah. Totally agree. Although I'm going to go get a thumb drive and try to download my genome on it. I don't think anything can go wrong if I do that as a next step. So we'll see how that goes. But another great episode.
Good luck with that, Ian.
Thanks, Nari. All right. Thanks so much. See you next time.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.